This week on Making Contact.
Unfortunately, we're fighting for fundamental constitutional rights. We're fighting to swing the pendulum back to where it should be in being able to exercise basic civil liberties.
In New York, during the 2004 Republican convention, police violated the rights of thousands of protesters. The violations included roundups of demonstrators, spying on nonviolent political activists, the use of agent provocateurs, and the faking of evidence. On this edition, in a collaboration with Abby Scheer of Public Eye magazine, we talk with New Yorkers who exposed the police abuses and lawyers in the cities where the Democratic and Republican Party conventions will be held this summer as they fight to prevent similar tactics. I'm Andrew Stelzer, your host this week on Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
The USA Patriot Act is widely criticized as an attempt by the government to suppress Americans' free speech rights. But sometimes, the actions of local police can be just as damaging to civil liberties. They evade public scrutiny because there's no law to blame for the behavior. Even worse, these tactics can then spread informally through expanding networks of police agencies. Chris Dunn, Associate Legal Director of the New York Civil Liberties Union, says this is exactly what's been happening with the New York City Police Department. Their tactics were on display in August of 2004 during the Republican National Convention.
Here in New York City, one of the most dramatic things that happened, and the thing that most people may be familiar with, is that there were large mass arrests of people involved in protest activity. Most of that was concentrated in a single day, where there were over 1,100 people arrested. The police closed off large areas and basically swept up everyone that was inside and arrested them all. In one of those locations, every single case was dismissed.
Beyond their sometimes intimidating presence on the streets, Dunn says the New York police secretly work to suppress protests before they even happen.
In the spring of 2003, we learned that the NYPD's intelligence division was interrogating people who were arrested at protests about their prior political activities and about their political affiliations. It was not until after the convention that we learned that, starting in 2003, the department had mounted a significant political surveillance operation that went far beyond questioning people arrested at demonstrations and involved infiltrating group meetings and tracking virtually every group they could identify as planning on coming to the convention.
The NYPD doesn't want to disclose the full extent of its spying, so it continues to battle it out in court. What is already clear is that their tactics interfered with citizens' ability to exercise free speech.
There was a very long delay in the police department issuing permits for marches and rallies, and it wasn't really until May, perhaps even June, that people started getting permits. And that created a lot of problems for people because there were, it's difficult to plan these events. You need to know whether or not you're going to be able to conduct it. Without a permit, you can't do it, legally at least.
The police devised rules so that those rounded up were held for arraignment or formal charging. They weren't released immediately with a summons, which is the usual practice.
Which, amongst other things, had the effect of keeping people off the street for further protest during the convention. And the second thing the department did, which was connected to the so-called no summons policy, was that it instituted a special policy of fingerprinting every single person who was arrested during the convention, regardless of how minor the offense. This violated New York state law, but more importantly for our purposes, created a dangerous precedent which the police department was building a database of fingerprints of political protesters. Shortly after we found out about the fingerprinting, right after the convention, we wrote to the police department and publicly released a letter objecting to the fingerprinting and told them we were going to sue. We did shortly thereafter file a lawsuit, but within 2 weeks of us having publicized this, the department informed us that it was going to destroy all the fingerprints, and it has done that. The thing that's remarkable about conventions is it is a once-in-a-four-year opportunity for people to come out in the street from across the country and have their say about what's happening politically in the country. It's one of the most important tests of civil liberties that we have as a free society. And frankly, New York City, we failed that test in 2004.
Eileen Clancy helped document police abuses in New York as director of the group Eyewitness Video. The videographers teamed up with volunteer legal observers from the National Lawyers Guild to collect and organize video during the convention.
Ultimately, 1,800 people were arrested in 2004. The New York Times estimated that 400 of those arrests were negated solely on the basis of video evidence. And we were able to bring to light information about police perjury and the district attorney's office doctoring video evidence. In one instance, a man who was arrested at the New York Public Library on August 31st, Dennis Kine, had a police officer swear up and down about all the terrible things that Dennis Kine had done. During the trial, the police officer testified for a couple of hours on the stand about how Dennis Kine had resisted arrest and how he'd moved his body around and done many things, whereupon the defense attorney produced a videotape showing that this officer had not even been involved in the arrest. I think a lot of people were shocked to imagine that the police would utterly fabricate a story to that extent over what really should have been a low-level arrest. Based on the New York Times front page story, when we brought them the information about this and about other perjury and problems with prosecutions, the Justice Department opened up a criminal civil rights investigation into NYPD practices during the Republican convention. As far as we know, that investigation has gone nowhere.
Clancy and Eyewitness Video also documented undercover police pretending to be protesters. In at least one instance, the actions of an undercover officer ended up instigating a confrontation between demonstrators and police.
He was arrested while he was simply standing on a sidewalk holding a sign. And when he was taken away, a videographer saw that although he was being arrested by a bunch of cops, he was not wearing any handcuffs. And after this man was taken away, the chief who was in charge at that scene ordered up a riot squad that then sailed into the crowd, who was yelling things like shame, 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 because they were very upset that the man who had been doing nothing was being arrested. And then they went into the crowd with batons raised and sort of wailing on people, and they then arrested two more people.
Come on, let's go. Get back. Get back. Get back.
So as we saw that man, the same man, we found him in pictures in other incidents doing other things that could be seen as provocative. Basically, we believe that that particular fellow was acting as an agent provocateur that was trying to get the crowd riled up to create a situation where the riot police would be called in, and then the folks would get arrested. We were able to prove that to the extent that the New York Times was interested, and they posted a video that we gave them and basically the results of our investigations and wrote a big front page story about it.
These tactics change the story the demonstrators are trying to tell. No matter what their message, they become troublemakers simply because they're arrested. Knowing that the police have spied on Quakers who are avowed pacifists, Clancy raises the question, do the police really think these groups are a national security threat? And if not, what are their real motives?
It's impossible to know all the reasons that cops are doing this. It does seem that police departments have been used really as political shock troops to carry out the work and the message of the current presidential administration in order to shut down demonstrations, to control them, to stop certain messages that they're not in favor of getting out, to get out.
Heidi Boghossian is the director of the National Lawyers Guild. She believes the tactics are an attempt to send a message to the public, to frighten people and prevent them from protesting.
Back up, please! Back up!
To be in a large crowd on the ground and to see scores of police on large horseback, the police wearing riot gear, and running down the street is a really frightening specter. And definitely, I think when it's covered in the news media before an event, as we saw before the Republican convention, front page pictures of police in helmets with riot gear, some on horseback, frightens people before they even get to the event. And I think really dissuades a lot of people from attending, especially if they're maybe older or first-time protest goers.
Eyewitness Video will partner with the National Lawyers Guild again in Denver, where the Democrats are holding their convention in late August, and in St. Paul, where the Republicans are meeting soon afterward. Already, Guild and ACLU lawyers are working in those cities to protect demonstrators' free speech rights at the 2008 conventions. Let's go to St. Paul first, where Bruce Nestor, a former Lawyers Guild president, is deep in negotiations with city officials.
Just look at the evidence of how protest and dissent has been treated at recent conventions, both Democratic and Republican conventions. And we're concerned that we will see the same type of repression from law enforcement and the internal security forces as we've seen recently. That includes intelligence, gathering information on people engaged in free speech activity, people engaged in nonviolent protest. It includes the use of devices and mechanisms at the time of protest, such as tall fences to bar people from having access to the target of the protest, the convention delegates, the use of pens to separate and confine people, as well as having an intimidating police presence, which we believe is really primarily designed to try to encourage people not to come because of the level of police presence, the nature of the police presence, the paramilitary appearance, the riot gear, the talking about violence, and trying to equate legitimate political protest with, basically conflate it with the fight against terrorism and the need to preserve national security.
St. Paul has the reputation of being a rather liberal place. Negotiations with government officials seem to be going well, but there are limits.
They're interested in negotiating agreements that the police will not behave in certain ways, meaning they will not expand the security zone beyond what's absolutely necessary. They won't put up fences that bar sight and sound access to the convention delegates. They won't make people who engage in protests be searched in order to get into an area where protest is allowed. People have the right to come to an event and be heard and think of themselves as a citizen, not just as a protester. When you're confined in a barricade or a pen, it's hard to get people to come and believe that that's really, they have a right to freely act and to freely express their opinion.
But surveillance may be another question. Local activists in St. Paul experienced unfamiliar scrutiny during a critical mass bike ride. That's a regular gathering of hundreds of cyclists who ride through streets to promote bike safety and green transportation. Nestor hopes the surveillance at critical mass wasn't a precursor for the upcoming convention.
The police responded to that by having a state patrol helicopter assigned to the ride, by having an undercover police car from the Information Sharing and Analysis Center, which is a public-private collaboration funded by federal money to protect the critical infrastructure of the United States. Now, I don't know how a bike ride of 400 to 500 people threatened the critical infrastructure of the United States, but it did allow for this undercover police car from this semi-private, semi-public agency to be assigned, a police helicopter, and a heavy police presence. Then there was, frankly, a police riot. The police claimed that they were going in to arrest individual bikers. In the process, widespread use of chemical weapons, of mace. They arrested 19 people on charges of riot. They were set with $3,000 bond and held over the weekend. Of those 19 people, five were charged with various forms of misdemeanors. So in a mini sense, what we see here is almost a dry run for how they might be planning to treat protesters during the convention.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. This program is a special collaboration with Public Eye, the quarterly publication of Political Research Associates. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. Or you can download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to Conventional Dissent, Defending Free Speech in the Streets at this summer's political conventions.
Bruce Nestor is the Minnesota president of the National Lawyers Guild. He's among those negotiating with Minneapolis-St. Paul police departments to make sure that protesters' free speech rights are protected at the 2008 Republican convention in early September.
We received a verbal commitment from the St. Paul Police Department yesterday, as well as statements made in testimony before a Minnesota Legislative Committee of the Minnesota House, that the St. Paul Police are not going to be engaging in intelligence and surveillance gathering upon people engaged in nonviolent political protest. Again, I hope that's followed through on.
But concerns about spying are one thing. Actually getting a permit to protest is another. By late March, the city had not yet approved a permit for an anti-war demonstration during the convention, forcing peace groups to sue. Then there's the question of what the federal police will do.
Since Bill Clinton, all national political conventions have been designated special national security events, which gives a key role to the federal internal security forces, including the Secret Service, to be responsible for security. Now, the representations made to us yesterday at the meeting with the St. Paul city officials was that that federal role is limited to providing security for the dignitaries and elected officials within the secure perimeter, the hard perimeter, as well as at times during transportation, and that the primary decisions outside of that secure perimeter will be made by the local police. Again, I don't know whether that representation is fully accurate. It may be that it's made believing that it's accurate, but what role the federal government will ultimately play when they, if they come in at the last moment and say, we're expanding this perimeter or this march can't go down this street at this time, you know, again, we're gonna have to wait and see how some of that happens. And so we're very concerned about the role that federal authorities will play.
And even if the local police and the feds behave, Nestor sees another danger in untrained police from smaller towns who will be coming to help and aren't used to demonstrations.
The difficulty is that there's massive funding made available to local police agencies, both in terms of overtime and personnel, but also to acquire new protective gear, I guess would be the law enforcement term for it. Well, if you have that riot gear, you have to use it. We're hoping to communicate to local law enforcement that that type of presence heightens a confrontation, isn't necessary, endangers them as well as the protesters. Whether they hear that message and will follow through on it, it's still too early to tell.
Bruce Nestor and other activists are also aware of the struggle in the media. They want to make sure the press doesn't create the same negative drumbeat about the threat from protesters heard in New York before the Republican convention in 2004.
We want to shift that debate to what the National Lawyers Guild has learned going all the way back to Seattle, Los Angeles Democratic Convention in 2000, Boston and New York in 2004, that the real threat to security, the threat to the Constitution and to public order comes from the police themselves. That's whether they're shooting rubber projectiles at people in Los Angeles, whether they're putting protesters in protest pens like they did in New York City, or corralling them in a protest pen like they did in Boston, widespread pattern of unconstitutional arrests, police lying under oath in support of their charges, and then the video taken by people acting as legal observers proves that police are lying, proves that police are submitting edited video in support of their charges. And so that's the message that we want to get out, is that the threat to security doesn't come from protesters. That's really part of the democratic exercise at a convention that's been reduced to a media show. The threat to order comes from police. And if civilian leadership, both elected and from the people themselves, set out what they expect, we hope to limit the behavior of the police.
We turn now to Denver, which has a very recent history of police repression against local activists. The Spy Files case was only resolved in 2004. It revealed local police spying against Denver peace activists, the Amnesty International chapter, and others. Before the 2004 Republican convention, the Denver FBI office contacted New York City police about a chapter of Food Not Bombs. This group, offering food to the homeless, then received a pre-convention visit from the police. Tom Sincotta is a National Lawyers Guild member. He's working with the coalition Recreate 68, organizing protests for the Democratic convention in August.
We are a very small legal community here, and we're trying to rise to this challenge of providing good legal advice and support for protesters who want to come and voice their opposition to the Democrats on whether it's immigration issues or the war or the lack of any, you know, attention to poverty and homelessness and racism in the candidates' campaigns.
Denver faces challenges similar to St. Paul.
Just as Bruce Nestor is engaging the Minnesota police departments in these pre-convention negotiations, we'd like to engage Denver and get them to agree, you know, for instance, to have only plainclothes police officers on the front lines and have cops in riot gear held in reserve, an agreement for no low-flying helicopters that also send that, you know, a very scary message to protesters, an agreement that officers need supervisory permission before less lethal weapons can be deployed or used on protesters. In effect, I think what we're looking for are common sense measures which will help reduce the likelihood of harm to anybody on the streets and reduce the likelihood of chaos or things spiraling out of control. So, you know, we're looking to protect free speech rights, but also we're looking to protect the lives and safety of citizens who are coming to speak too.
And to make matters worse, the city has decided to change its system of issuing permits.
This new process gives the mayor authority to enter some emergency rules by calling this an extraordinary event. That seems on par with the, you know, Secret Service being able to call something like the DNC a national security special event.
A local ACLU lawyer said he's never seen that kind of permit scheme anywhere. The Denver lawyers are also unclear how the permit changes will affect the demonstrators. Another obstacle? New cite and release rules similar to those in New York. That's where activists are not issued summonses for civil disobedience, but instead are taken into custody, fingerprinted, and booked.
This is the first we ever heard that this was an ongoing policy. You know, we think it smacks of vindictive prosecution. This is saying we're going to treat protesters differently than your common criminal who violates the city code. The only other charge I'm aware of that carries a mandatory arrest is an act of domestic violence. After Chief Batista shared that with us, Mark Silverstein of the ACLU drafted a letter urging them to move off of that policy. But no policy changes have been announced.
And like Minneapolis, Denver has seen a dress rehearsal for the convention at a demonstration last October.
Approximately 82 people were arrested at the Columbus Day protests on October 6, 2007. They were all hauled into jail, booked, and even though by mid-afternoon on Saturday, most had posted a $500 bond, more than 90% were held until Sunday morning the next day until they were released. This is a clear indication that the city is trying to punish people for exercising free speech or for engaging in what they classify as civil disobedience, and is trying to threaten people from engaging in any kind of behavior like that.
Even though Denver police set up their own policies to supposedly curb political surveillance after the Spy Files scandal, the city already has seen some undercover activity
With regard to the undercovers, Denver police dispatched what's called their Vice 50 team, which is a squad of undercover officers who typically dress in, they make themselves out to look like college students or protesters. You'll see them wearing grungy clothing or, it's usually the guy with the backpack on for some reason. But one of our protesters saw them engaging in more police-type activities and called them out as protesters and said, supposedly, excuse me, officer, I want to take a picture of you. And while he was doing this, a number of officers descended upon him. And a supervisor then actually broke up the detention and let this person go. But he was later recontacted by police and charged with interference. But not only that, I thought it was very interesting that they contacted this person's college and in a formal complaint asked that the student be disciplined for violating the college's disciplinary code. And this happened within maybe 2 weeks of the arrest. I thought this was really out of the ordinary and really a sign that they want to protect this undercover surveillance and undercover activity.
Unfortunately, we're fighting for fundamental constitutional rights. We're fighting to swing the pendulum back to where it should be in being able to exercise basic civil liberties, being able to carry a picket sign and wear what you want, say what you want, voice your opposition to government policies and candidates' positions.
For Making Contact, in a special collaboration with Public Eye magazine, I'm Abby Scher in New York.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Thanks to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew, and our partners at Public Eye for their collaboration on this program. Special thanks to Jeff Brady, producer of Law and Disorder on WBAI in New York. Our theme music is by the Charlie Hunter Trio. For a CD copy of program number 1908, call the National Radio Project at 800-529-5736. Or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Rudman is our executive director, Tina Rubio, senior producer, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy, intern. And I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.